So this is in line with that thinking that really you can't, even if you're a horizontal product, you still have to make some difficult decisions about who your someones are going to be. Who are you going to have everything for? Because even if you have a horizontal product, there are going to be different use cases, and you are going to have to make hard decisions with incomplete information as the founder or as the product leader about what to build and what to say no to. Listening to Startups for the Rest of Us. I'm your host, Rob Walling, and today I'm going to be covering some solo topics. There's a listener question or two thrown in here, but they are questions that I think apply to a Rob solo adventure. First topic I'd like to cover today is about testing pricing for your product. And this came about when I asked Twitter for questions when Derek Reimer was going to be on the show, and we got more questions than we had time to cover. So this question was an overflow that I saved in a questions Trello board. It's from Kat at buildthekeyword.com, and she asks, how do you test different prices for your product? And the answer is, there are several different ways to do this. Testing pricing is hard, but the thing to think about is there's testing pricing for brand new customers who are coming to your website or doing a demo or sales call. And then there is changing pricing on existing customers, notifying them you're currently paying $50, it's going up to $100 or $75. Separate those two things in your mind. Because what you don't want to do is change and test prices on existing customers without being really confident that those price changes are in order. And so usually you test it on new folks coming in. And I have only known of one SaaS company that ever tested prices. Everyone else just does not have the volume. And frankly, it is so much work to do this well. So there's, I mean, it's truly just split testing, like having people click and the price appear differently, you know, like the standard split test definition that we talk about. So it's not something that I see almost anyone doing. So usually the way that you test pricing, if you have a low touch funnel, is you go to your pricing page and you just change the pricing on it. You see how it impacts your conversion rate over the next week or month. And I've called this a poor person's split test before, which is, it's not ideal, it's not scientific, but if you have a real pulse on your business and you have a decent flow of traffic and prospects and people coming across, you know, your pricing page, frankly, then you can see patterns. And when I used to test pricing, it was only when I had a lot of folks hitting that pricing page, because if it's a trickle, you can't see the difference. It doesn't, there's too much noise. And so usually most people don't look at changing their pricing as a test. They often say, I'm going all in and I'm just going to change my pricing. Like, I think I'm priced too low, or I think the value metric is off. And they go to the pricing page and the Stripe call and they just change it. And I'll say hope for the best, but really it's a calculated risk, right? It's a calculated gamble of odds are pretty good. I'm underpriced. I feel like I'm underpriced. I'm going to solve that by raising all of my tiers, or by, let's say, dropping my lowest tier, something people frequently do. So, you know, I've seen several tiny seed founders do that. And then trying to make it work. And there were times when I've raised prices where I was just like, I'm committed to making this price point work. It's called aspirational pricing, right? I aspire for my product to be worth this much. This is the business I want to build. It has this pricing. And therefore, I'm going to keep building features to where this price is a no-brainer. And you can say, I want my price points to be $1,000. That's the minimum. And it's like, yeah, it'll take you years to get there. You know, or you're just in the wrong category to have that kind of price point. There's all kinds of ways I can poke holes in what I just said. But for me, it worked, right? It allowed me to build a great business. If you are doing demos and it's like one call closes or it's procurement or whatever, and it's a high touch sales environment, you can just unpublish your pricing from your website. And you can either say starts at $4.99 a month, starts at $1,000 a month, whatever it is, or you can list some pricing and call us, or you can just not list pricing at all. Have a pricing page. When they click through, say, hey, click here to talk to our demo team. You can say our sales team. You can say, click here to talk to the founder to learn more about how we, you know, structure the product and how this works. And then you kind of split test it a bit and you start quoting prices that are higher than what you're currently charging, basically, and you see the reaction. You see if folks choke, or you see if folks, usually what you'll do is you'll double your price and someone will say, oh yeah, great, and they still sign up. And then you'll double it again and maybe get some pushback from a few, but you realize, oh, I can still close some deals. This is how I think of testing pricing. And notice I haven't said testing price drops. That does happen. It's just very, very infrequent. Usually if you're testing, you are trying to test the price elasticity of your space and of the folks who visit your website, right? Or of the folks who are raising their hands and becoming leads for you. It is an inexact science. It just always is. So is attribution. When people are clicking through and converting, like, where did all these leads come from? Well, you can't attribute 100%. Can you attribute 60 or 70%? Yeah, probably. Is that good enough? Is that the best you can do? It probably is. It's the same with any hard decision where you have incomplete information. You do the best that you can. And part of it is some founder gut. You collect what data you can and you make observations. And then you make a bit of a gut decision about, should I continue with this price increase? Or is it not working? Like, have I kind of killed the business? Or not even killed the business, have I slowed the growth? And it's not just testing pricing, right? It could be, I'm going to add a credit card before a free trial. I'm going to remove the credit card before a free trial. I want to try freemium. I want to discontinue freemium. I want to keep the pricing the same, but I just want to change the structure. I want to change the value metric. So my tiers are still 50, 100, 200, but maybe I don't price based on storage. Now it's priced on emails sent or whatever, right? There's a bunch of different things you can do here. And before I did these, I would always have a conversation, well, A, with myself, but B, with a couple other trusted folks that I had. So was this a co-founder? Is this an advisor? Is this someone in my mastermind? Is it a mentor if you're in a program like Tiny Seed? And I would get the best advice that I knew how to get. I would factor that in with my own gut feeling, and then I would test. And for me, most of the time, I was dealing with like low, medium touch funnels. So I could test on the website, and we also had a lot of traffic. So it allowed me to quickly, I wasn't split testing, keep in mind, but I knew historically in any given week how many new trials we got, and in any given week how many new conversions we had. And so I could see within a week, I was like, okay, we're still on track, but our pricing's increased from there, or we're ahead of track. You know, you could get a gauge for it early. It wasn't definitive, but it made me feel more comfortable with it. Testing pricing is hard. It really is. But I would actually say you have an advantage if you are doing high touch, if you're doing demos, and that allows you to have conversations with people, and also allows you, you double the price, you quote it to them and they say, wow, that's out of our budget. And then you say, oh, well, what is the budget? You know, what is your budget? Or, you know, we can work with you. Like, for example, if you want to pay annually, I can knock 20% off of that, you know, and I'm not saying sell from your heels. You know, I'm not saying you just back up instantly, but when you are increasing prices, there are ways to back off that increase in real time on a sales call if you realize that you have potentially overquoted for this particular prospect. So thanks for that question, Kat. I hope it was helpful. My next topic is about one-time payments, especially folks talking about them on Twitter. And it is usually kind of the indie hacker founders who are now doing, I don't know if they're following in the Basecamp steps of doing once, they're doing lifetime deals on SaaS, which doesn't quite, I mean, who is it? Einar and I were talking on this show, might have been Derek, where I said, if you collect one-time lifetime payments for a SaaS, but you now need to keep that SaaS running for years and years and years, is it a little bit, I don't want to say Ponzi scheme, I know you're not doing that intentionally, but basically if you don't sell additional lifetimes a year from now, you will be paying server costs, hosting costs, whatever, all the other costs, storage costs, whatever else is there, even maintenance costs, unless you're doing everything yourself, you are taking that out of one-time earnings that you got 12 months ago. And so it's just an odd model. One-time software makes sense if you download it and install it, and there is, you know, quote-unquote, no maintenance. I don't need to do bug fixes. I don't need to maintain server infrastructure and all that. But that's one of my struggles with it. But the other struggle is I almost feel like people don't understand how different one-time revenue is from recurring revenue. Because even like monthly recurring revenue is the gold standard, right? And this is like the cheat code of every other business where they want to get paid monthly on a predictable schedule. SaaS has that cheat code built in by default. And so you've heard me talk about the cheat codes of SaaS being net negative churn and a handful of others. But even annual revenue, when it's recurring, can be tricky. And it can seem like, I'm gonna give you an example. We'll get folks who apply for Tiny Seed, and you'll see their revenue over the past 6 months. We ask for MRR, and you'll see it going up. And it'll be like 6 months ago, it was 1,000. And then it was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. And we're like, well, this is an interesting early stage business, right? For a business to be growing that quickly over that short a period of time, obviously they, depending on their customer count and all this, they have some product market fit. Someone is wanting to buy this. They're sticking around. This growth, they know how to market. You know, there's signals there. It's early, but you see it. And then we'll get on a call with them and we'll realize they are collecting annual payments. And so all those numbers have to be divided by 12 because it's actually $6,000 of ARR, of annual recurring revenue they collected, which divided by 12 is only $500 a month of MRR. So really quickly, we can have a $6,000 MRR business that appeared to be that way, but wasn't actually, suddenly become a $500 MRR business, which frankly is at the bottom end of the threshold at which we would even consider funding a company. So it went from this amazing business to, oh, this is, I won't say unfundable, but as a general rule, we don't fund companies, you know, with MRR that low. So that's just going from monthly to annual. One time is another order of magnitude removed from this, to where this is like the old days where I started the first of every month with .NET Invoice, which was $300 downloadable software. First of every month, $0 in revenue. And it was such an uphill battle to grow that business. And it was, you know, it was a step one business. There's a bunch of things around it. So I'm not trying to extrapolate my experience with that one thing. But once I went to recurring, I swear I will never go back. Recurring revenue is where it's at. And whether you're doing annual, I'm not saying monthly is better than annual or anything like that, but I really want to caution you against getting caught up in kind of what feels like zigging when everyone else is zagging, but just doing it for the sake of being a contrarian. And it feels kind of like this willful belief in something that, as I'm saying, annual and recurring and doing the math and then saying one time is just so, so much less valuable than that. There are folks on Twitter in the indie hacker community who are posting these one-time things and acting like it's a big deal. And it's like, it's something, but you're selling a lifetime, whatever, for $50. You're just competing on price at that point. And I guess that's good to get your brand out there. You know, there are pros and cons to this, but this is not the kind of business you should aspire to. If you're listening to this podcast and you view it as a step in the direction of trying to get your name out, great. Be really aware what you're getting into if you're going to be charging lifetime or one-time deals. It's not a never for me, but it's a be very, very cautious of how you think about that revenue. As Ruben Gomez says, he did an AppSumo deal and he views those users, he got paid once and he made, I forget what the number is, 33,000 or something from it. And AppSumo takes the lion's share. They take 70 or 80%, I believe. He views them as freemium users. He says, I don't even think of them as paid users. And that's how you need to think about it. They are free users that you happen to get a check at one point to maybe help you develop, to maybe help you build. I think that's a much more healthy way to do it. And personally, I can't imagine ever doing lifetime deals, actually. Yeah, because, and then those customers, if you go to try to sell this app, now they are a liability because you have to service them and there is no ongoing revenue. So there are some problems with it. It's not a never do, but it's a highly discouraged. If a tiny seed company came to me and said they were going to do a lifetime deal, it's like forking your code base. It's like translating it into other languages. It's like launching a second product. I would be pretty hard against it unless they convince me that they have thought through all of the ramifications, both positive and negative, and they could convince me why it's the right choice. We've been partnering with Lemon.io for several years, and they've proven to be a great choice when it comes to hiring for a highly skilled developer to work on your project. Here are five reasons why you should consider working with Lemon.io. Number one, the time from your request to getting a candidate is just 48 hours. Number two, their developers have previously worked with tech giants like Apple, Google, Netflix, Airbnb, Intel, and Lego. Number three, they only provide senior devs with an average of 7 years experience. Number four, their talent pool covers more than 300 dev languages and frameworks. And lastly, number five, your hire comes with a zero-risk replacement guarantee. Customers of Lemon.io typically stick around for at least a year, proving they know how to gain your trust by delivering consistent results. Quit wasting time searching for a solid developer at a great price. Get in touch with Lemon.io. As a bonus for our podcast listeners, you'll get a 15% discount on your first 4 weeks of working with a developer at lemon.io/startups. That's lemon.io/startups. My next topic is one from Des Trainer. I saw a tweet from him. He's the co-founder of Intercom, which I believe is a unicorn company. Aren't they worth a few billion? He spoke at MicroConf several years back. He's a good dude. And I invited him actually to speak at a recent MicroConf, but he's busy. You know, he said he has a hard time getting out and about and speaking at events. But he tweeted, having something for everyone gets you acquisition. Having everything for someone gets you retention. Choose wisely. What an insightful tweet. I respect Des a lot as a product thinker. If you've heard any of his conference talks, frankly, he's done talks at YC, he's done talks at MicroConf. Search him up on YouTube, and his thinking just really, it always lines up with a lot of the things I'm thinking, but it takes him to the next level. He says things that once he says them, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's brilliant. Oh my gosh, that's obvious. But it wasn't obvious before he said it. And that's the best type of philosophy or, you know, thinking that I like, which is something that makes me realize something new. It educates me, but it feels very also intuitive at the same time. So I love this idea. Having something for everyone gets you acquisition. Having everything for someone gets you retention. And choose wisely. He's implying you have to choose between those, because in a perfect world, wouldn't we have a bunch of stuff for everyone so that we could acquire new customers? And then we could have everything for just one or two of those ICPs. But what he's saying is then you lose the others. They all churn out, right? So this is in line with that thinking that really you can't, even if you're a horizontal product, you still have to make some difficult decisions about who your someones are going to be. Who are you going to have everything for? Because even if you have a horizontal product, there are going to be different use cases, and you are going to have to make hard decisions with incomplete information as the founder or as the product leader about what to build and what to say no to. And so this is where realizing who your ideal customers are, who are your best customers, who are the ones that are least price sensitive, who are the ones that get the most value out of your product, that churn the least, that are the, I don't know, the best to work with, and that they just love it and stick around and they tell the friends, you know, they do all these things that help push the business forward. And those are the folks that you try to build everything for. And it can often be hard to find those people or to know what their commonalities are. It might be as simple for you as it was when I built my last startup, Trip. Originally, I was like, well, it's going to be SaaS founders and bloggers are using it and WordPress plugin developers. And there might have been one other, but I think those were the first three. And what I realized quickly was WordPress plugin developers were not actually a great audience for us. A bunch of reasons for it, but it became obvious that really SaaS founders, because there wasn't a great ESP for SaaS at the time, and then bloggers, because they were trying to move automations, you know, move up from MailChimp or move down from Infusionsoft. Then what we realized is we actually were naturally, organically acquiring e-commerce customers. 15% of our customer base was e-com, and we had never marketed to e-com. So something was... It was surprising to me when we found that out. Like, I didn't know, you know, we had a few thousand customers. We had a virtual assistant. This is before AI. I'd have AI do this now, but we had a virtual assistant go through and categorize a big sampling of them. And it turns out that, like, it was surprising to me that so many e-com folks were using it. That later, you know, that there was later a pivot to focus on e-com after I left or as I was transitioning out. And now it's been a pivot back to where it's more of a general email marketing tool and not going specifically after e-com. But those realizations of Trip's a horizontal play. It is an ESP. It could be used by anyone. We had people, we had realtors using it. We had folks building custom bespoke tailoring in London. We had podcasters. We had all this stuff. We had internet marketers, info marketers, course makers, you know, all this stuff. And that was actually the third. I was grouping bloggers with kind of course folks. I think today they're called what, makers or creators, but that term wasn't really around back then. What that made us realize though is I could bucket the feature request into, oh, they're SaaS, so they're going to want this. So I want to build some stuff for SaaS. We did realize that SaaS wanted to go down a path that was really complicated. And so at a certain point, we kind of backed off it, I'll say. And folks like customer.io and UserList have done a much better job of catering to SaaS. But the bloggers, the course creators, and e-com were folks that we were taking comments, thoughts, and really trying to serve. No, what we also realized was that bloggers were high churn. And bloggers really hopped around. So they would quickly switch, or they would stop blogging. That's what we saw a lot. So bloggers, and they were very price sensitive, actually. So it became this interesting balance of you can have a few ICPs, especially if you have a larger team, but you can't have 20, right? You would need separate products if you're going to do that. You would need a lot of folks working. Can you imagine one code base that catered towards 20 different ideal customer profiles? It'd be a mess. And that's what I like about what Des is saying here, right? Is having something for everyone gets you acquisition. Having everything for someone gets you retention. So that idea of having everything for one ICP in the early days, and then two, and then three, and maybe you never even get to three. Maybe you do only have, you know, a specific vertical where you're targeting HR representatives that work for construction firms, for example, and that is your vertical. Then maybe you really do have one ICP, and that makes it even easier. And then you build everything for that someone. At a certain point, you tap out your total reachable market, and then you get to decide, do I build a second product for this same ICP, or do I expand into an adjacent vertical? Do I move to be more horizontal? Do I raise prices? Do I, you know, whatever else, like you figure out how to get past that plateau. But having something for everyone, a little bit for everyone, it can get people in the door. But does it create the long-term retention and you know, net negative churn and expansion revenue, loyal customers, retention, all that? It's hard to do that, right? You have to build a product that your ideal customers love and need and solves a desperate pain point, desperate enough that they are willing to stick around through the ups and the downs. And it's easier said than done. But that's why I liked Des's relatively succinct yet elegant statement of choosing wisely which you focus on. My last topic is on recommending things to other people. And this is like a person-to-person recommendation thing I'm thinking about. As an example, when I recommend a biography to someone, I will say, even if you don't know this person or know their story, it's a really good story, right? This is like Phil Knight with Shoe Dog. I don't really care about the advent of Nike and the start of the company. In fact, I didn't even wear Nikes in when I was a runner. I love Asics. The idea of Nike was just like, okay, is this going to be interesting? And it is so well written. Like if you're listening to this and you haven't read or listened to Shoe Dog, I recommend it. It's an incredible story. And one of the best parts is that it ends right at, it's a startup story because it ends, I believe, right before they go public. And it's like, once they go public, I don't really care. I don't want to hear the trials and tribulations of being a big company. This is not something that interests me. So that's one of those books where I'm pretty opinionated. Even if you don't know the person, it's good. Versus the Sid Meier autobiography. If you don't know who Sid Meier is, you don't know the games he made, it's fine. But it's like really cool if you know Civilization, right? His book's called Sid Meier, A Memoir or something like that. And if you know some of the games he created and you hear him, the touch points are really interesting. Another one is Masters of Doom, which is a story of id Software that made Doom and Quake and Wolfenstein 3D. And even if I never played any of those games, didn't really care about them, even if you haven't, it's incredible. It's one of my favorite audiobooks of all time. And then there are others where, again, you need to know the person in order to be super interested in it. I actually felt like John Romero, who is one of the id Software guys, has a book. It's an autobiography called Doom Guy. And that one was similar where it's like, this is cool. But if you don't know him or don't know the story, I think it's less interesting. So you kind of have to weigh that. The reason I'm bringing this up is I think this is a helpful mindset or helpful framework to think about why you're recommending someone and letting someone know that. It's like having strong taste about particular elements of it, because I get recommended, I'll ask on Twitter, or I will just get recommended stuff. And I'm often like, what did you like about it? Because I want to figure out if our tastes are online enough that it's worth my time, because it's not the cost, right? Buying a book, whether it's on Audible or on Kindle or in Dead Tree version, the cost is irrelevant for me. It is the time it's going to take me to get into it and evaluate it. And so I dig in pretty deep on recommendations. I've had a lot of recommendations, like I will ask specifically, hey, I'm looking for a book that goes deep on like SaaS or startup marketing approaches. And I'll say tactics, specifically marketing tactics. I want to know a good one to recommend to people. And people will just recommend just crazy random shit like Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. And I'm like, that's not a startup market. What are you talking about? You know, or someone recommended The Lean Startup. And it's like, he talks almost nothing about marketing. There's nothing about marketing tactics in there. And it's this fundamental misunderstanding of like what the question asker, it's like they see a keyword. It's like the AI, maybe it was an AI answer. I don't know, man. It's like they see a keyword that says startup and the AI writes something. But you didn't think it through. And so usually I have a follow-up question of like, if I didn't know any better, I wouldn't know those were not good suggestions for what I was looking for. And that's why when, if I'm going to recommend something to anyone, to a friend or to a startup founder, I will tell them, I recommend you read this book and here is specifically why. And in fact, I recommended Chet Holmes' Ultimate Sales Machine today. And what I said is, I think the book's like 20 years old, so it's a little dated. I also think there's about a third of it that you don't need to read. And there's a third of it that is really focused on the Dream 100 customers. And I think that's what you really need. And then there's a third that's about business operations. And you can read that if you want to. But really the reason I'm recommending it to you is because of this whole concept around sales and how he does sales. And even though it's outdated today, you'll get the idea and you can adapt it. That recommendation is so much more helpful than me saying you should read this book. Because not only does it tell you why, it kind of puts guardrails around like which part should you really focus on. If you really like it, read the whole thing. But you really, in the interest of your time being valuable, you can probably just read the part about the Dream 100. It allows them to think internally, oh, this is why I should or shouldn't read this. And it allows them to think, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe the recommendation is off and I get to make that decision. So I think being pretty descriptive when you make recommendations is something, certainly something that I'm doing. And I hope it's something that you will consider doing as well. That's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me this week and every week. I'll be back in your ears again 1 week from now. Same time, same place. This is Rob Walling signing off from episode 719.